the presidency of Millard Fillmore not only ushered in the abandonment of emancipation, but did so in such a manner that in his post-presidency, even him running will reinforce the abolitionist platform of the Republican Party that will make it the mainstay, a main party of the United States till today.
Like, right.
He screwed up so bad that he created ripple effects that we're still living in.
Welcome back to the Buck Starts Here podcast that digs deep into juicy stories, power plays, and wild twists that shape the presidencies of the United States. My name's Kyle, the Alice Liddell to Eric's Lewis Carroll. Today we're about to find out just how much of the Tyler precedent Mr. Fillmore is ready to follow. So last we left off, I think he was just stepping into the roles after Mr. Zachary Taylor's unfortunate early demise. We're about to figure out how he's going to do things, huh?
I think up to this point, it's hard not to like Millard Fillmore. But you're going
you're about to rug us.
I don't know if I'm going to rug you, but let me just hit you with a quote from Harry S. Truman. Harry S. Truman characterized Millard Fillmore as a weak, trivial, thumb twaddler who would do nothing to offend anyone. And Truman also says he's partially responsible for the Civil War. So how do we go from a man who seems like he would be a competent legislator, who was a competent legislator, who would be a competent administrator running the country in a pivotal time, consensus builder, a coalition builder, well-educated attorney with an incredibly hard-working attitude, to a president who is considered one of the worst presidents ever?
Really, that bad?
Yep, he is in the same, a lot of times he's put in the same category as James Buchanan. And nobody should be in the same category as James Buchanan. That's insane to me. But in the same category as Buchanan and Johnson. And
I think our worst score so far has been for Tyler. You think he's on that level?
No, he's worse. He's likely going to be our worst score. And it's going to be in. So I wanted the first episode to be us discussing Millard Fillmore as a person, because so many of that, of his actual character, is maligned by people only looking at his 3 years as president. But I don't get to write history. So let's start. July 9th, 1850, the day that Zachary Taylor died, is also the day that Millard Fillmore is sworn in as the president of the United States.
Does he do the same as Tyler did and address Congress?
No, he does not. He does not. He does follow the Tyler standard as assuming those reins. So he does immediately start governing as president. So what made the Tyler standard so important was that it was the immediate assumption of full presidential powers.
He just took it.
Yeah. So. He was overseeing, I would describe, a non-conventional political agenda because of the looming risks of the expansion of slavery. And I said 1850, so what are we got to obviously talk about the Compromise of 1850. So originally, Millard Fillmore, unlike Taylor, he very quickly signaled to Congress that he would be open to supporting a negotiated legislative settlement to calm sectional tensions. Taylor wasn't going to accept that. Taylor was going to go to war.
This is letting other slave states come in to equal the balance. Is this what we're talking about?
Yeah, this is how we ended up with California. Yep. So Taylor was not going to accept that at all. He was going to go to war. He didn't care. He did not. He was not a sectionalist. Millard Fillmore, I don't believe, was a sectionalist either, but he's a man of compromise. Unfortunately, compromise works great if you're the state comptroller. It works great if you're the vice president. It works great if you're a legislator. Our system's not built to work for a president of this level of compromise. So he supported this negotiated settlement that would eventually become the Compromise of 1850 to calm sectional tensions. Now, what I want to be clear about this, he did not inherit the Compromise of 1850. Did it exist in Congress? Absolutely. Did the ideas exist previously? But they saw Zachary Taylor sitting there with a veto pen. But real quick, let's do a quick refresher on the Copyright Act 1850. It's five pieces of legislation. First, it admits California's into the union as a free state, which was obviously interesting because of how far south it is. It did allow for what's called popular sovereignty in Utah and New Mexico, and that's where you would see the residents of these territories would vote whether to allow slavery in there. That was seen as a victory for the South, allowing for that. It does lead to bloody Kansas and Nebraska. It sets the pretense for that.
Oh, that's the one where people were going up there to like crossing the line, state lines to influence the vote.
Popular sovereignty. It finally abolished the slave trade in D.C., but it went for the North, but it did create the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. Destroyed Millard Fillmore's presidency, and it did set the boundaries for Texas. Now, the Compromise of 1850 is considered one of the most complicated pieces of legislation ever in the history of the United States. It's five pieces of legislation wearing a hat as one piece. It has all these crazy far-reaching parts that would not be conducive to this conversation about Millard Fillmore if we're going to have. We should talk about it. I know Kyle and I have to. I know Laura edited it out, but Kyle and I have talked about. We'll do a show on it. It's going to be really interesting from in a sense of the causal effects from here. But with that said, if we this will be a 3.5 hour show if we go down this road. So we're just going to respectfully say Compromise of 1850 would definitely not have occurred under Taylor, right? Those five laws were Taylor would have signed the ones that the North won on. He would have wanted in as a free. He would have probably signed the Texas border. Zachary Taylor was not a fan of popular sovereignty.
The Fugitive Slave Act was also a big no. Yeah.
I mean, his whole history would be not doing that.
Yes.
He would not have done popular sovereignty because he didn't believe it was for the people to decide. But Millard Fillmore, a man of who likes compromise and all that stuff and is an institutionalist, he would have definitely been okay with it. He would have been, he was. That's why he didn't see the long-term effects of a lot. And it's very ironic because he didn't see the long-term effects of allowing people to vote on constitutionality. Well, he also constantly hit behind constitutionality to enforce the Fugitive Slave Act. Mm-hmm. So 1850, the five bills that make up the Compromise 1850 hit his desk. He signs them. California, it's admitted as a free state. September 1850 immediately entered. By this point, the gold rush had already been in full swing for 49 or so.
At least a year.
This intensified the southern sphere of the eventual imbalance in the Senate. This, as Kyle said, this ends up with that popular sovereignty going into Utah and New Mexico, really starting to push the slave issue. This drives sectionalism. Millard Fillmore did not see this coming. I don't think he saw this coming. Zachary Taylor saw this coming from a mile away. He was like, this is going to be horrific. But Zachary Taylor is a general. He's a man used to giving decisions and being responsible for them. Millard Fillmore is a coalition builder. That's not a bad quality to have. In this case, it's a horrible quality to have.
It sounds like you need a Zachary Taylor to oversee that guy. I think you need somebody to give him the guidance and be able to take responsibility for those decisions.
Yeah, you Kyle, 100% right, man. Like, you need a Zachary Taylor. A Zachary Taylor also needs a Millard Fillmore to help build that underlying coalition not result in everything being Zachary Taylor having to show up and venue military tactics on you.
Yeah, because that's not the right answer either.
I still think that elite cavalry was probably so confused. And like, oh, he's missing us. He's not hitting us with this grape shot. And then watching everything catch fire, and you're like, oh.
Yeah.
Oh, we're not prepared for this war at all. But the most consequential portion of the Compromise 1850 is the Fugitive Slave Act, which was passed in 1850. He signed it and treated its enforcement as a constitutional obligation of the executive branch. And again, this has become the defining thing of his administration. So he viewed the Fugitive Slave Act enforcement as something he had to do. That Congress passed a law, and him as the executive has to enforce it. And he did not exercise any executive power.
He didn't veto?
No, he signed it. It was part of the Compromise 1850. So all five had to be passed for it to be a compromise. Okay. That was the only way that the South would have revolted. Which it did.
It did anyway,
Literally did. Right. So Millard Fillmore gets no credit for preserving the Union for that one, even if it's only for 10 years.
Right.
So he had this consistent position that once a federal law was enacted that required enforcement, no matter what his personal discomfort or if there was regional opposition or if even it went against his morals, he had to enforce it. And he will pay in the historical narrative for that belief. It is very interesting.
Why is it the Millard Fillmores that say, no, I got to follow the rules, when it's the Andrew Jacksons who are like, ah, forget it, Supreme Court, who cares?
Yeah, or even more interesting that Zachary Taylor, a slave owner, was not willing to enforce or even consider the he thought it was insane, the Fugitive Slave Act, and a man who never owned a slave was willing to enforce it based on his interpretation of the Constitution.
That's wild.
So for those that don't know, the Fugitive Slave Act was more or less, it's the Fugitive Slave Act and the Dred Scott decision that ended the ability for a constitutional solution to slavery. I'm going to get a little opinionated here. It is not that it ended the discussion about slavery. It just rendered emancipation effectively off the table. So as Kyle and I have talked about in the past, there is emancipationists and there are abolitionists. Yeah. Emancipationists is a reason we don't remember that word from school. So we were never taught it. Emancipationists believe that you could progressively get rid of slavery by slowly and procedurally passing laws that would render it useless over time. And you're going to say, oh, but what's an example of emancipationism? Virtually the majority of states, the Compromise of 1850, the Fugitive Slave Act, and the Dred Scott decision effectively end emancipationism in the United States. Now, emancipationism had some success in the United States. In fact, the Constitution is partly an emancipationist document because it ends the slave trade in 1808.
That's right, yeah.
It is ingrained in how a lot of constitutions were constructed, obviously from the state level upwards, is this idea of emancipation. How emancipation was going to occur was something that was always conveniently not defined. And it was always, well, we can do this, we can do that. But the Dred Scott decision and the Fugitive Slave Act ended that. Now, the reason it ended the idea of emancipation is because the Fugitive Slave Act in the ruling on the Dred Scott decision effectively meant that you, as a Southerner, could buy slaves and move to a free state with all your slaves. And there was really nothing the free state could do to stop it. Mm-hmm. And this basically turned every emancipationist into an abolitionist.
I can see why. I can see why.
Right.
You're basically just now saying that state sovereignty or the populist sovereignty not only goes one way, basically. Right?
Only goes one way. Yeah. Because you as a Northerner can't go to the South and free slaves.
Right.
That's called abolitionism.
Yes.
It is what will happen. It's what will happen is that this is why I believe this is why Truman does that quote we started off with. I believe that's why Truman had such a negative feeling for Millard Fillmore, for a man who was anti-slavery, is because his lack of a strong backbone, his lack of his lack of foresight was horrible. It basically his signing of the Compromise 1850, which was not the elected official who he got his position from, because that elected official died.
If you feel like one of the discussions we're having is whether or not like he felt like he had a mandate for his presidency, right? After inheriting it, if you feel that way, like, don't you at least stick with the same thing that the guy before you was harping on, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, and what's interesting is that you brought up a great point earlier about the Tyler standard and the Tyler precedent. And part of that, the Tyler precedent, isn't necessarily just addressing Congress. It's about assuming the president holistically, right? It's about being the president, not the interim president, not the placeholder president. You wonder if that didn't happen. You wonder if there wasn't the Tyler precedent. Would Millard Fillmore, who's an institutionalist, would he have been like, well, my predecessor didn't want to sign this, so I have no right to sign it?
I wonder if he even wants to assume the presidency if there was no Tyler precedent. I bet you. Right, I wouldn't be surprised if he doesn't ask for an election to go get somebody else to take the spot for him.
Kyle, that's a great point. That is an excellent point. Dude, it is weird to think William Henry Harrison dying basically led to some dude agreeing to the Fugitive Slave Act who didn't own slaves. That's kind of scary. Like, Tippa Canoe and Tyler, too, he got sick after his speech. And, like, that's how we learn about these people. And then we're like, do you remember Mill Fillmore? People are like, no. And it's like, well, do you remember the Civil War? Do you remember Abraham Lincoln? He ends up, the Northern Whigs completely disavow him. They view him as a traitor. They view him as somebody who's now aligned with all these Southern demands. The South never warms up to him. They're suspicious of him. And, you know, Miller Fillmore does not do a good job of laying those fears. He's like, I'm just enforcing the law, but he's still very open about his belief system. So the South's like, well, I don't want this. The Southerners really don't want to deal with it. I'm not talking about the Southern Whigs and the Jackson Democrats. He ends up trying to form this, what can best be described as a Union First presidency, and where he's trying to have a very procedural presidency that respects the Constitution, that really focuses on institutional steadiness. He is not the charismatic person he is in person. He's not that at the president. He's seen as stiff. He's seen as, an instructionalist, like we do X, we do Y.
What do you mean by, is that like another word for micromanager?
No, more like follow step A, B, C, D. And it's like, well, what about your thoughts on this? No, A, B, C,
D. No, we don't think. We just do.
We just do, right? And he's not trying to build popular consensus. He's like, well, I'm the president. It's outlined in the Constitution how I handle this. He really can never – he never ends up being able to replace what Zachary Taylor brought to the presidency, which is hard to replace. Like, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But he is seen as stiff. Congress starts kind of dictating what's going on. He's a coalition builder, but he doesn't necessarily understand that the executive branch, I don't say doesn't understand, he's smarter than me. He doesn't foresee the battle of Congress versus the presidency. To him, he's like, the Constitution says it goes this way. It doesn't understand that, like, power abhors a vacuum. Like, Congress is going to take that responsibility. He ends up overseeing a lot. Obviously, he ends up overseeing a lot of expansionists of the United States. And when I say a lot, I mean it's nothing compared to like Jefferson and
did we get the Gadsden Purchase yet?
Yeah, like it's not. It's stuff like that. It's these smaller procedural purchases, but they're still interesting because they're more expansion than we see post his presidency. Because obviously we go into a very contentious period. So he oversees, you know, that kind of the procedural expansion that was happening over time. Obviously, the Compromise of the 1850s is adding definitive territory and definitive pathways to statehood. Yes. Pathways to statehood? I don't know. That made no sense. Pathhood? What is a pathhood?
You said it so convincingly that I was willing to just roll with it.
I'm very proud of myself for that.
I did not even question that. Yeah, that's pretty good.
At this time, there's some interesting geopolitics stuff going around where this is not going to surprise you at all, but Miller Fillmore was obviously very commerce-centric. So he's managing these great power rivalries that are occurring, but he's staying neutral. He's just like, he doesn't want to rock the boat. He's trying to maintain strong commercial relationships with every country in Europe.
Is he having any successes? Like, are we at least on the commercial side, economically? Yeah. Okay.
Nah, economics, I don't not really having a major play in it. It's kind of like you get that post all those reforms in the 1840s. Post
still trying to catch up and recover from the panic of 1837.
Yeah, right. It's like that like reforming process. It's kind of like the U.S. in the 2010s, where it's like, oh, there's all this great GDP growth, all this great stock market growth, but it's not like the product of presidential decision making. I'm not, by the way, I'm not trying to contemporary. There's, of course, president affects the economy, but you know what I'm saying. It's that these reforms that had occurred under a previous reaction to a recession.
We're more still trying to reestablish a banking system at this point.
Right? Kyle, 100% right. That's a great way to put it. We're still like, shit, banks need to work, and like England's finally loaning us money again. Yep. Our economy's going to grow, but it's only because we screwed up so bad the other way. But so he specifically, we start, actually funny, we actually start seeing canal interest at this point in Panama.
Oh, yeah.
Is that cool?
The Erie Canal, the Great Lakes canals, I think, were like undertaken around this time frame too, weren't they?
Yep. So the Erie Canal modernization occurred, around this time. Dude, it's crazy to think they built like the first Erie Canals in like late 1700s, early 1800s. Like, this wild. And those were like pusher barges.
The one that linked the Great Lakes to all the Great Lakes, basically, and the Illinois River. I think this is all part of this package that was happening around this time.
So we see this, mass modernization. He was successful on the commercial side, but it was moderate success. It was nothing to, build a presidency around.
But the bar had been lowered pretty low. It's not that hard to exceed it.
but the 1850s, especially it's interesting in Cuba, there's a bunch of, adventures by American private companies on how to, go into Cuba and start building up commercial interests. Fillmore did not like these ventures at all. He thought they were dangerous to U.S. foreign relations, and he worked to discover them, to suppress them. And there were some people who wanted us to like annex Cuba, but Bill Fillmore was like, he just didn't want to touch any of it. He just wanted trade, no wars, and and compromise. And he caused a war. he caused the bloodiest war in U.S. history. He didn't cause it, but he played a major role because he removed emancipationism as an option. There was always that option of, we're going to meet in the middle at emancipation, and him signing and enforcing the Fugitive Slave Act ended that. So there's now one option. If Southern slave owners can bring their slaves to the North, well, the North is like, well, fine, I can bring freedom to the South. If you're going to do that, it's both ways.
Do you think maybe he did have the foresight and knew that this was a way to maybe force it to come to a head and get resolved?
Yeah, but it's the worst possible. If you do have the force,
that's the worst way to do it.
Oh, I'm going to crash into this tree. Well, at least I saw the tree coming. It's like, that doesn't change it. You don't get credit for crashing into the tree because you saw it coming.
Fair enough.
Now, something that he did want to do is he wanted to establish formal relations with Japan. So he does. So the reason we have anime is Bill Fillmore. I guess we can say that. No, I'm fine. Do what? I'm fine saying that. So he was the one who sent the expedition by Commodore Matthew Perry, which is, I always forget his name is Matthew Perry. I don't know why that makes me laugh. So he does have success with Japan. But I would say that's probably like one of his biggest successes. I mean, if your biggest success is like not starting a war with Europe and then causing the Civil War, like that's not a success.
Not really.
Well, back home during this time period is we start to see the Whig Party fully collapse. He's the last Whig. I mean, that's how bad are you that you're the last president of your party?
Ooh,
he killed the party.
Yeah.
The Whig Party both saw a contraction in membership, and any membership remaining splintered. The Northern Whigs completely alienated. They were completely alienated by the Fugitive Slave Act. And its enforcement. They hated the enforcement. They hated the compromise. They hated anything. The Southern Whigs were like, basically had fully entered sectional parity. They almost didn't even view themselves as part of the United States. They viewed themselves more as like, well, fine. They don't trust Millet Fillmore. They got everything they wanted on the Fugitive Slave Act, and they still don't trust him. So that kind of, the Whigs basically view him as a non-starter. The Whigs are now seeing the North getting all riled up. That's like, this is insane. But don't forget, the Southerners in Congress were also upset in the Congress of 1850 because California was a free state. So they were this fear of imbalance in the Senate was materializing in front of them. So they're going, oh my God, emancipation's dead. The North is upset. And now you're going to have more senators. So what happens now?
It's abolitionism. This is really spectacular. Bad compromise that you made everybody unhappy.
Yeah, that was like my previous thing on like the compromise of 1850 is like super crazy. It's really hard to even discuss it in like a small setting because it's like it took the brakes off the train for the Civil War. Like, it was like, okay, we're having a war. It was like, cool, we're having a war.
So did this also lead to, is this what led to the creation of the modern Republican Party?
So as the Whigs started to fraction, we did see the Know Nothing Party coming to intern, and you see like the free soil party. No, nothing party's funny. Right. You're supposed to tell, like, I don't know nothing about that.
It sounds like Fight Club.
How's that a party?
I don't know nothing.
So 1852, the election cycle of 1852 rolls around. He did not emerge as the Whigs nominee for 1852.
This is after your party's already dead and you still can't get your nominee.
Yeah. And the Whig Party specifically says because of Compromise of 1850, and they viewed it not as a settlement, which is, this must have been disheartening to Miller Fillmore, because he kind of always hung his hat on, I'm enforcing this, I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. I'm the president, I'm enforcing what Congress passed. So it must have been weird to him to hear them say, like, you did wrong. It's like, no, I passed a law that you voted for too. And it's like, well, you're the president. You have the ability to veto. And they specifically hung the Compromise of 1850 on him. They said, no, you created a fault line within the party that wouldn't heal. And Winfield Scott gets the nomination, which I think is kind of funny. Because, like, when you think of Winfield Scott, you don't think of him as, like, presidential candidate in 1852, right? You think of him as a general. And obviously, our next guy we'll talk about, Franklin Pierce, ends up getting the nomination and winning. So, Fillmore ends up becoming one of the most interesting moments in political history in the United States, where he is a sitting president who cannot win his own nomination to his party.
All right, so we got to... loses the primary election. Is there anything else from presidency that we need to cover here?
Nope. We just go into one of the most interesting post-presidency of all time. So his presidency ends on March 4th, 1853. Immediately, he's offered no reprieve. His wife, Abigail, passes away almost immediately after he leaves the White House. And he goes back. This is before presidential pensions. He's not a wealthy landowner. He's a lawyer. He doesn't know what to do. He doesn't know how, as a president, he's supposed to conduct himself after he leaves office, especially in the way he left. And so he leaves office, and he goes back to practicing law. And he's talking to one of his friends, and he basically says, like, I don't know how to be a former president. I don't know. I can't just go sit on my estate. He can't be John Adams, who can go sit on his land because his wife was a diligent investor and Adams used to say, hold court with his animals.
The impression that we've gotten from Fillmore doesn't sound like the kind of guy who wants to sit on his butt anyway. And right?
100% right, Kyle. So he says to his friend, I don't know what to do. And I need to work, but, you know, I also, we have successful legal practice and all that. So his friend goes, tour Europe. Go tour the world.
Yeah.
You know, go.
Why not?
You know, go and essentially, like, go enjoy yourself.
Go meet the Queen of England.
Yeah, exactly. So he ends up agreeing with his friend. So he ends up going and touring Europe. He probably the only interesting piece of trivia that you would hear on, like, a trivia night in a bar is he meets with Queen Victoria. Queen Victoria responded that he was the handsomest man she had ever met. She doesn't say that to Miller Fillmore. She actually remarks it to her court. So she was obviously be a big friend. She'd be a big fan of Alex Baldwin.
Okay, hold on. So now I had read that there's speculation over that was just her being polite. But if it wasn't even said to him, how is that being polite? That's just
no. She just thinks she thought he was a good-looking guy.
Right.
he ends up visiting all these courts. He goes to Italy. He goes to Germany. So Miller Fillmore, he tours all over Europe. He's in all these different courts, and this is where we really have a lot of. You know, a lot of pieces on how charismatic he is, on how, you know, friendly of a guy he is to be around. But it's this coalition aspect, what makes him so agreeable, that really doomed his presidency. So he's rejuvenated. He comes back to the United States. And in the mid-1850s, he returns to Buffalo, New York. And he kind of establishes himself as part of this law practice. And by this point, he really started accumulating wealth. And he has all these philanthropic interests. He's known for, like, donating money to anything. Like, he didn't have, like, one thing he really wanted to donate to. It was education. It was cultural institution. It was just charitable initiatives. He basically, like, gets called, like, the local statesman. And he's very visible. He's very respected because he's not in the decision-making role. He's not in that hardline role. So he's... no, he's kind of fun to go talk to. He has all these stories, and he's personable. And he starts feeling a lot more comfortable, right? He starts feeling like that's what he's meant to do. Well, by 1856, there's this national movement called the American Party, also known as, more commonly known as what we learn about in school, is called the Know Nothing Party. Mm-hmm. This is a great, like, random one to, like, throw out to, like, your, like, political junkie friend, is be like, oh, who ran for the Know Nothing ticket? No one did, because it's not a party. It's the American Party. It's a good way to get, like, some political junkie to get angry at you. Like, oh, no, no, I learned it this way.
Yeah. Sounds like a good way to get a fight.
Right. So the Whig Party is gone. It's effectively collapsed. The American Party inherits that shell. It does not last long. It's a very weird party. It has all this anxiety over immigration and all these cultural changes. It focuses heavy on the desire for wider spirit political reform and anti-corruption movements. But it's really cosplaying as an anti-sectionalism party, because so many people agree are anti-corruption, right? There's nobody, like, nobody's running on pro-corruption campaign.
Right.
immigration anxiety exists throughout the rest of the whole entire country at this point.
Is there kind of like a pro-immigrant candidate? Like,
yeah, right. Like, right. Even like, even because, right, like, either you're pro-immigrant, like, I feel like people, I feel like pro-immigrant people are just
economists.
Like, they have other right. They just have like other things they also support. We're like, right, there's our single voter. Single voters just for the immigration issue. So he runs for president again in 1856, and he's running on this kind of idea of, let's stabilize everything. Let's not be sectionalist. Let's just be union first, is what he calls it. And it doesn't work. And it's ironic because he's the one who made union first a non-option. He doesn't
win. Why would he want to do it again? After his first experience, you'd think he'd be like, no, thank you. Unless he wanted a chance to try to do it better.
Yeah, exactly, right? But this is kind of a really interesting moment in American political history. There are many political scientists say that this election is election 1856 and the utterly defeat of the American Party. I mean, the problem with the American Party at this point is not so much that people don't agree with the platform. They just don't believe it has any legs. They just
have no faith in the ability to execute whatever their plan is.
Yep, exactly. So, also, there's a horrible narrative like, oh, Mill Fillmore stole votes from Fremont, the Republican who was running.
Mm-hmm.
No, he didn't. John C. Fremont, he was like, he got 114 Electoral College votes. Mill Fillmore got 8.
Yeah, I don't think that was.
Yeah. Jinju Kim got 174.
How?
Yeah. Right. Like, the only argument you may have is that, the popular vote would have went to Fremont, but I've seen but those are mostly just, you would have just more won northern states. It's not necessarily I mean, at this point, New York has 35 electoral college votes. Like, it is
right.
I mean, New York's a powerhouse. It is funny at this point. California had 4.
No,
how do I find that funny?
Wild to think about, right?
And Florida had even less. Florida only had 3. So this creates, effectively ends the Whig Party, shows that the Republican Party is the alternative to the Democratic Party. And interesting enough, it is this election that converts the Republican Party into the parody party, the Democratic Party. And it sounds weird to say, because, you know, we like to talk about, you know, Abraham Lincoln being the first Republican Party, Republican president, and he is, but he's not the first nominee of the Republican Party.
Right.
Exactly. Right. And this is interesting because we have not left that period yet. There has not been a rise of a major third party candidate. There has not been, we have not seen success in coming up on 200 years of a third party. Every other major democracy is a coalition, not the United States. So this, the presidency of Millard Fillmore not only ushered in the abandonment of emancipation, but did so in such a manner that in his post-presidency, even him running will reinforce the abolitionist platform of the Republican Party that will make it the mainstay a main party of the United States till today. Like,
right.
He screwed up so bad that he created ripple effects that we're still living in. Like,
ooh, this is gonna be a fun one to rank.
Right. So as we transition out, he continues to kind of just have these weird political opinions. He, during the Civil War, he votes for Stephen Douglas in the 1860. He votes against Abraham Lincoln. So he votes for the Democratic candidate. Then votes in 1864. He's living in New York, by the way. In 1864, yeah. He then votes for General McClellan. He votes for he votes for the opposite side of the ticket. He votes for the Democrat. We're still fighting the Civil War.
Who do you think? Who do you think did his insurance?
Oh, right, yeah. After the war. Yeah. That is my favorite. Like, just such.
I'm never gonna let that one go.
He ends up having a second marriage in 1858. He marries his wife Caroline. You know, very similar. He is a it's a very positive relationship from everything I can read on it. It's his second marriage is not less documented, but it's not as prominent as a marriage to Abigail. During the Civil War, he actually raises the city guard, which is a group of guardsmen who are protecting Buffalo, because at this point there was concerns that there'd be a southern invasion through Canada, because the Brits were still...
I remember hearing about this. Yes.
The Brits were... The South was like, yo, Brits, you can take America back. And they were like, aren't you also America? And aren't you also angry? We're not going to... You started the war. We're not going to... What? Why would we... Why do we trust you?
Right.
We're not going to like let you come into our country. You're warmongers. What are you talking about? Also, we trade with the North.
They're the ones who make everything.
Yeah, like we would like to own America again, but like, geez, this is going to be a... We got our own stuff going on, guys.
Right.
It's a potato. No, the potato family was before that. So he ends up, but even more ironic, when Abraham Lincoln dies, he leads the guard when his train stops in Buffalo. So, and he has this like weird respect for Abraham Lincoln, even though he like didn't support Abraham Lincoln.
Is it just because of his unionist? Maybe just wanted to keep the union together. He didn't want to vote for anything that would tear it apart.
100% red, buddy. So he has this union first identity is what will define him in his years. So, but after it was all said and done, because his presidency, he survived for so long after his presidency. He passes away in 1874. He's exists in this weird reality where he's seen very prominent. Within his local community, but he's not reviled, but worse, he's forgotten about. His identity on the national circuit for the last 15, 20 years of his life is kind of ignored. That people don't really seek out his opinion. Some people did would occasionally ask for his opinion, but during the Civil War, he hedged everything he ever said. And so people really stopped caring.
It's almost like he became too much of a politician. Like he went, right? Like he just leaned too much into the political speak and never actually doing anything.
So while in Buffalo, he remained a respected civic philanthropist that he had this idea of this early era Whig who was a statesman and all his ability to build coalitions. By the end of his life, he's just seen as a man who once held a position. And in truth, he lived long enough to see a man who failed at his position, failed while he was president. He failed his mission, his life goal to preserve the Union. He caused the rupture. And he would pass away March 8th, 1874, after he actually was in great health. Like his doctors noted, he's in great health. He suffered a fairly massive stroke and passed away about a week after the stroke on March 8th, 1874. And that would be the end of Millard Fillmore. One of the most interesting presidents, because for such a great man, he had greater failures when he had to make a decision. All because he focused too much on compromise. He fell outside. Compromise is good, but he compromised to the point where it caused the destruction of the one thing he wanted to preserve.
Yeah. Man, he's going to really hit on strategic vision, I think, because...
I don't know even how to list a positive thing.
Okay.
Well, I genuinely don't know. He didn't found the Whig Party at all. Like, that's my thing. Like, you could maybe give him points for the Whig Party, but it's very clear that he didn't think about founding a party. He just happened to agree with the platform. You don't get credit for agreeing with a platform.
See if we can find some points.
I'm curious how you're going to rank this, Kyle, because I have become Miller Fillmore blind, where you just had to sit here and listen to me rant about this.
I like to try to play devil's advocate, see if I can find him some points. So we'll see if we can dig anything up for this guy here. So use our patented POTUS ranking scale here. Political influence, overall governance, transformational leadership, understanding public needs and strategic vision. As always, we start off with political influence, president's ability to shape the political landscape, including the impact on their party dynamics, legislative agendas, and long-term political shifts.
He fractured the party. Like, he didn't understand his party at all. Like,
so...
what's the lowest score?
Hold on. Wait a second now. Now, if I read this just as it written, it's the ability to shape and affect. Sounds like he made a lot of shaping and affecting of this. I mean, running into the ground and destroying it, I think, is shaping it in a way, right?
I would argue he affected it. I don't know if he shaped it. I mean, if I take am I shaping a tree when I cut it down?
If you throw something into the ground and turn it into a pancake, that's a shape, right?
It is. So what's the lowest score?
What score do you want to give this guy here?
I think
we've done a negative before. Tyler got a negative 3.5.
What do we give him a negative 3.5 for? Total score?
No, for just that political influence.
Oh. Dude, Tyler deserved that. He definitely deserved that. All right, was he worse than Tyler?
He has to be, right? I don't know how you don't kill
Let's go -4 because you destroyed your party forever. The party doesn't exist anymore. It doesn't exist anymore. You're the last of your party.
Can that be -5?
Could be negative. Let's go -5.
All right. Overall governance. Effectiveness of the administration in implementing policies, managing the bureaucracy, and maintaining stability in governance.
-5. He didn't maintain the bureaucracy at all. Like, he destroyed the bureaucracy because he set fire to the house.
I mean, he did try to maintain some stability. He did prolong the Civil War for at least a decade. But he also put it on the path towards the Civil War, too.
Kyle, you're right about this. I'm wrong. I skipped over the stability on that. He did it. He didn't make the Civil War start in 1850. So it was going to start. Zachary Taylor was willing to start the war.
Right.
That's kind of what made him awesome. He was like, oh, screw it. We'll start it here.
But, I mean, is it really maintaining stability if you also put yourself on a path that you know for sure now you're going to come to this bloody conflict as opposed to still having an off-ramp that's not bloody?
See, I think Miller Fillmore believed there were going to be other solutions down the road. I don't think he had the foresight to see the Fugitive Slave Act ending emancipationism.
Right. Maybe he just believed in the Union too much.
Yeah. So I don't want. Yeah, you're right. The stability.
He should get something for that, but I mean, he should get the bureaucracy. For that. No.
Yeah. Want to give him like a 1? Zero or something like that. I don't want to go negative.
No, I like 1's fair.
Yeah, let's do a 1.
No, never mind. Make that 0. Like,
0.5.
Okay, let's split the difference. Transformational leadership. Capacity to enact significant changes or reforms that alter the course of history. Did they address pressing societal issues and implement lasting change? That last one hurts him. He did not address the societal issues. He tried to push them off, is what it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, it is lasting change.
It's really bad change. It's really bad. So was Jackson's, and he got good scores, though.
Yeah, part of me is that it was so horrific. But he did it on purpose. Jackson knew what he was... No, he didn't. Jackson sucks.
Yeah.
Kyle, what are you thinking on this? You're better. You're way more objective than me on this.
He did enact significant change and reforms, but I mean, like nobody, I don't know. The Foresight's in another spot, so maybe we don't. I feel like that's like balanced out by the fact that he didn't address the pressing societal issues.
Yeah.
You know what
just
I mean?
Do you want to do like a two?
Yeah, okay. That seems reasonable. I can live with that. Understanding of public needs. How well do you understand and respond to the needs and concerns of the American public?
Did it.
Did he engage with citizens and address their priorities effectively?
Oh, but do we give him points for his commerce? People love
Did
anime.
Anybody give a crap about commerce at this point in time?
I don't think there's any great benefit because he's like, I didn't start a war with Europe. It's like, what, were you trying to start a war with Europe? You don't get credit for no- Yeah, no, right. I've already said it. I agree. Never mind. I agree. Because I said... Yes, I specifically made the joke that not starting war you shouldn't get points for. I'm trying to give points for not starting war.
Right?
Yeah, never mind. Yeah, so like, honestly, yeah. 0.5.
I feel like you can go zero on that one if you really wanted to.
You can go zero. Yeah, I'm fine going zero on it.
And then strategic vision. Did he have clarity and ambition for the country?
Negative seven.
Okay.
I'm assuming negative seven is the lowest score we give somebody.
I think that's the lowest we can go. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's go. With
that's
negative
the high
seven.
End. Oh wow! This will be our first negative.
It should be. It should be.
Minus 9.5, I think.
That honestly feels too high for it. Dude, he also heavily campaigned that we should have been, like, super nice to the South after the Civil War. Not like the Lincoln, like, oh, the you know, that type of reformist. Like, hey, let's get them back in the fold. He was like, we should be bros with them. And we're like, dude, we just fought huge war against them. Like, they should be Americans, but we shouldn't be, like, overly nice to them.
I know, right? Yeah. All right, well, I think we got through the sexiest president to date, right? Is anybody right? I mean, who else?
You could be like, into Jefferson with like tall blonde hair, like blue eyes.
Strawberry blonde. But I hear you made a good case for Ford.
Oh, Ford's the best looking president.
You think Ford over Millard?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Ford was like a model.
Yeah,
like
he was, but did he have heads of royalty fawning
there
over
were,
him?
There were people who were, you gotta do more research, but I've heard that like the foreign. Like foreign diplomats were like pretty good, or foreign power brokers. Yeah. Let's use that term. Were like a pretty good looking guy. He's also like 6'5". Right. Oh, huge jack, right. All American football player. Yeah, he is. Our two best looking presidents weren't elected. That's funny.
Right. Isn't that? Wow, that's wild. That's a fun fact.
Yeah, I hate to say it, but I think it's my boy Adams is probably lower on that list.
The good looking.
Yeah.
Which one, JQA or John Adams?
I'd say John
JQA
Adams.
JQA looks better than John Adams, I think. John Adams.
Yeah, by a pretty good margin. Yeah. John Sr. is like.
He had a little
pudgy.
Too much of the sweets.
Yeah, he's
no
just...
teeth. All right. Well, I think. Okay, so next week we should start wrapping up with season two because I think Franklin Pierce is going to be the end of this
Franklin
era, right?
Pierce, yeah.
All right. So that means we'll be in the middle of the Civil War before you know it. In the meantime, you can tell us what you think of Fillmore's looks. Was the queen just being kind, or was she dumped Prince Albert for a shot at being the first lady? If you're Canadian, Australian, or British, or anyone else who probably wants an apology, you can email us at buckstartsherepodcast@gmail.com. Also hit the thumbs down twice so we get double punished. We'll see you all next week. Produced by China Shop Productions.